Hello and welcome to this week's Inside Education. The program's website is insideed.com, where you can listen to or download podcasts of all previous Inside Education programs. I'm Sean Delaney, and you can follow the program on Twitter with the handle @InsideEd. The Computers and Education Society of Ireland, or CESI for short, held its 2018 annual conference in Dublin City University last weekend, and it had the theme Shaping Tomorrow Today. The CESI conference is an interesting one in education because it attracts participants from many sectors of the education system and because it's aware of how technology can change our conception of education. This week I'm pleased to bring you one of the interviews I recorded at the conference. Pamela O'Brien lectures in mathematics and programming at the Tipperary campus of Limerick Institute of Technology. She is passionate about integrating technology in education, and she is an organiser of the ICT in Education Conference, a mentor at Coder Dojo in Limerick, and a facilitator of the Connected Classrooms project. I met up with Pam on the evening before she gave her workshop at the conference, and I asked Pam to tell me about the content of that workshop.
The workshop I'm doing tomorrow is on Breakout EDU, so it's really about problem-based and game-based learning. And what I actually have tomorrow is I have a toolbox that will have a number of locks on it, and there will be clues that the attendees will have to work through to come up with solutions that will get them to open the locks. So, for example, I have 4-digit locks, I have 5-digit locks, I have 3-digit locks, I have word locks. So they have to work through the clues and actually come up with what will get them the code that will open that lock, and then once they open all 8 locks, then they'll get into the box. But it's that idea of working through clues, and it's about problems-based learning. It's about, you know, teamwork. It's about working together to actually get to a solution to something. I've used it in classrooms myself. I've used it in Coder Dojo. I've used it with primary schools. I've used it with my own third level students. Just even from a teamwork point of view, it's fascinating. It's fascinating to see how people approach problems. And it's just interesting and useful to see, you know, you can get many different facets from it.
And is this a physical box that you're talking about, is it a picture?
No, it's actually a physical box that I bought in Homebase. It's actually a toolbox, a big red toolbox. And I've put 8 different locks on that toolbox. So you have to break all of them. So you have to break the codes for all of them to actually get into the box to get whatever. Now, I've put chocolate in it sometimes. I've put various different things. For Coder Dojo, sometimes what we do is we actually have, you know, the USB keys that they need to access the materials or various different things like that into it. So that's, you know, you can use it for lots of different things. The key is that people work together, that they, you know, approach a problem and come up with a solution to that problem.
So my first reaction to that is that for a technology conference, that's very low tech.
It is very low tech, and I suppose that's one of the things I've found over the years. I'm involved in the ICT in Education Conference, which is a conference similar to the CESI conference here today, which is, you know, for teachers, it's around introducing technology into the classroom. But technology, it doesn't always have to be about in-your-face technology. It's actually about different ways of approaching things. It's about problem solving. It's about looking at things in different ways. I'm also involved in a cert in coding and computational thinking for teachers, which we are running in LIT since October. And we have been very conscious at the workshops that we have unplugged kind of things as well. So, you know, some of the things that we've done have been very much around computational thinking. So it's not about having computers in the room. And we've actually taken the teachers out of the labs, the computer labs, for that session. We've taken them into a tutorial room. One of the things I did with them was we worked with Lego. So they had to make Lego models and then come up with the algorithm to make that and give that to the other members of the team. So it's actually about breaking down problems.
Okay, and if we stay with the locked box problem for
yes,
a minute.
Yes.
So you literally have these locks on all of the boxes as well.
Yeah, so there's one box and then I have 8 locks on, or well, actually in this case I think I have two boxes and I have 8 locks. So they have to work through, and I have 8 envelopes, each with clues in there. So there's a clue in each envelope.
And they know which envelope relates to which lock?
No, not at all. That's all part of the thing. So I tell them at the beginning, you have, I think it's 3 4-digit locks. There's a 3-digit lock, there's a 5-digit lock, there's a directional lock, there's a word lock, and then there's just a key lock. So there's 8 different things that they have to come up with. Now, some of them, it's obvious from them that maybe this one is going to be a 3-digit lock because they have to add up lots of different things and they come up with 3 digits, and it's which one is going to open the lock.
So what would a typical clue be?
Well, one of the clues is around using Morse code. So, you know, there's a number of different clues and there's a number of different sports, and then you have to pick out the 4 sports, and for each sport there's a number of medals, and that gives you the code to open that 4-digit lock. There's another one which is really interesting. It's about giving you a set of instructions to work out one number out of the 100 square that is left if you take out all the multiples of 5 and all the multiples of 3 and whatever, and it leaves you one number. And then they have to do that twice. And when you put the two numbers together, that gives you a 4-digit lock. That is the one that has driven primary school children, third level children, teachers. It has driven them all mad. They're all saying, there is no one number. And I'm like, yes, there is. You have to go back and actually read the instructions. And that's what it comes back to. How good are you at following instructions, which has so many applications within computing, and really it's just about that.
Well, that's what I was going to ask you next, because you're doing it here with adults and teachers who should be fairly good at these kinds of problems, but what other ages have you done this problem with?
I've done it with Coder Dojo attendees, so they've been anything from 5 or 6 up to 13, 14.
Would you use different clues for them?
The one that I'm using tomorrow I have used across the board, and it is fascinating. I used it with my third level students. And I've used it at first year as kind of an icebreaker type of an exercise. I've used it at third year for a teamwork to see how they actually work in teams. And that is fascinating as well. And actually, you kind of think, yeah, some of these things, they should get them like that. And they actually don't. Sometimes we are just a little bit preconditioned to think that there's something more to it. And actually, there's not. It's just, do you follow the instructions? Can you work your way through a set of instructions and get to an answer?
Where did you get the idea?
I went to a session down in Cork, Mag Zammond, who just is amazing at just putting out stuff, and then suddenly it's like, okay, well, if Mag says it's good, I need to go there. So there was this thing on last September, 12 months in Cork, on a Saturday. There was about 20 of us there. This lady, Lynn, came over from the States. She was holidaying in Ireland. She's one of the people behind it, said that she'd do a session on it, and I went down there, and it was just amazing, because it was just, the possibilities are endless. One of the things we've done in Coder Dojo is I've got the kids themselves to come up with the clues. And they're really clever in how they do that.
It's just fascinating. How do you come up with clues?
Well, I'm using one of the ones that's already there. So there's actually a website, breakoutedu.com. And there are a number of games. I've been a little bit, not lazy, but this one works. So I use it over and over again. And it works across the levels. As you've said, you know, I've used it across a number of different ages. And it works equally well across all ages. So I've used that one. But I've also come up with some of my own. So, for example, I've used some of the clues aren't particularly, they're quite US-based, some of them. One or two of them haven't really worked for me, so I've taken those ones out and I've put in my own ones. One of the ones I've put in is just converting a hexadecimal number to its decimal equivalent, and that one has worked very well as well. Some people are like, what is this? And I literally just give them a number with a 16 as a subscript, and I don't tell them anymore. So it's like they're scratching their heads thinking, what's this about? And then they get it. Oh, maybe it's something different. And that just works very well as well. So some of them I do tailor a little bit. For example, that one I couldn't use in a primary school because they don't know what hexadecimal numbers is. But I actually use the Roman numerals instead. So it's just, you tailor it a little bit for the different ages, but actually I haven't had to tailor it very much. But it's fascinating to watch how people tackle it. They're given 8 clues, they're given 8 locks, and like, how do we, where do we? And then suddenly they start working as a team and they work together and they...
And that's what I was going to ask you. What do they learn from doing this activity?
Well, it's just, I suppose, how do you break down a problem? How do you, when you don't know... At that session that I went to, the introductory one that I went to last September, 12 months, we did 2 ones. We did the one that I'm going to do tomorrow, but then we did another one which was much more complex. And literally that second one, and I have that printed out for tomorrow as well, it's literally just an envelope with about 10 pieces of paper in there. There's no direction as to which ones. There's some red herrings in there. No direction as to where do you go, how do you know which one is which, where is it all linking together. No direction on that at all. And that one is really interesting to see how that one's going as well. So it's just, for some of them, and for tomorrow, I chose to go with the one that's a little bit more directed, because I think you need to show people that they could use it in their own classrooms, and I think that one would be useful in their own classrooms.
And about how many will work on it at a time?
I've used it with my group in the Cert and Coding, and we had nearly 30 people, but I put them into teams then. So I had 4 different teams, and that introduced a little bit of competitive edge, because the first person to get all 8 of them wins it. So that gives the competitive edge. I found that with my college students, that competitive edge, some of them weren't really that engaged, and then they saw that other people were getting more of the clues and had more of the locks open, and then suddenly it's like, okay, we need to actually get moving here and get something done. So that competitive edge does have an impact as well.
And from a practical point of view, the locks, like, did you just go into shops and buy combination locks?
Homebase, Amazon, a few of those.
But then, like, you're at the mercy of the particular codes that are on the locks that you pick.
But all those locks are resettable. But I always, this is one thing, note to self, after I go home, when I've put them on, I actually reset them all to zero. Because if I don't set them to zero, then I come back the next time, like, don't know what code is going to open this particular lock, or I have them written somewhere. I have a list of this one is this. And I've used it a few times now, so I kind of know what they're generally going to be. So it kind of works. But actually, one of the things I have to do tonight is just make sure that I have everything set the way it should be. Because I know I was actually coming up in the car today, and I was like, okay, one of those is set wrong. I need to reset it. So I just need to actually figure out what way I need to go about doing these things. It's a very tactile, physical thing, but there's a lot to learn from it.
You said you work in LIT in the Thurles campus. Can you tell me a little bit about the work you do there?
Well, I do a lot of different things there. I'm a lecturer on our computing suite of programs. So we have computing and games design development, and I've lectured on those for a number of years in the maths area and in the programming area. We run the ICT and Education Conference. So that's a conference very similar to the SESI one, which is aimed at providing opportunities for teachers to share. Like, we have keynote speakers, but actually for me, most of the real sauce in the conference is giving people an opportunity to meet, to share what they're doing, to learn from each other. Because actually, if you hear somebody else is doing it in their classroom, you're probably more inclined to try it rather than somebody talking in general about how something might work. So that's one of the things we do. We also have the Cert in Coding and Computational Thinking for Teachers, which is really an opportunity for us to help teachers to bring coding into their classrooms. And we've gone very much with the practical, hands-on, you know, doing micro bits. So learning how to code in Microbits, App Inventor, HTML and Python. So it's very practical, very hands-on. And I have to say, I'm loving that interaction with teachers. It's just fantastic. It's great to be in that space as we are now getting into bringing computer science into classrooms.
If I ask you about the conference as well, what's it called again?
The ICT and Education Conference.
And how can people find out more about it?
Well, we have a new website coming soon. It will be www.ictedu.ie.
ictedu.ie.
Yeah, so I can send you on the link to that. It's not actually up just now. We're literally in the process of getting it up and running for this year's event. This year's event is on the 28th of April, but it will be putting out information about our keynote speakers. There will be a call for presenters as well, so for people who want to present either just a presentation or actually do a workshop as well.
And you said you've come at this from a mathematics point of view or from a mathematical perspective.
Yeah.
So how did you become interested in maths and in science and in computers yourself?
I wasn't terribly interested in computers. I feel like a little bit of a fraud at these kinds of events. I'm not a techie by nature, I suppose. I loved maths in school, my favourite subject. I knew when it came to CAO time, maths was where I wanted to be. I didn't really think through anything more than that, other than that I wanted to do maths. I did applied maths in UL. It was a huge shock to my system when I went into UL and suddenly I'm doing programming, and this is more years ago than I care to remember. But I ended up programming, and it was this alien foreign thing that I had no clue of, I had never seen before. And I really struggled with it, I have to say. It wasn't my favourite subject by any manner of means. But I went on work placement, and back then the only jobs you could get from a maths degree on work placement were a programming job. So I ended up in a programming job, not being able to program. And that's being hand on heart. But actually, the programs I wrote were being used to do real things. And that's when I got it. And actually, when I went back to college after work placement, then I got the programming. So when I came out of college, I programmed for 7 years. I was a statistician in Eagle Star for a number of years. And I've been a lecturer for a number of years as well. So I've kind of come at it from a few different perspectives.
And could you tease out your interest in maths? Where do you think that came from? What, like, did maths come easily to you, or was there an inspirational teacher along the way?
Oh yeah, absolutely. It was a teacher. I loved it. I loved having to break it down. I loved having to get to a point where I understood it.
But you didn't find it easy?
No, I worked hard at it. I mean, you know, back then I did honours maths. There were six in my year. There was 120 of us. I was in an all-girls school, but it came down to an inspirational teacher. Mary Hawk was my teacher. She was magnificent. She was guiding, she was supportive, but she didn't give us the answers. She made us work at it. And for me, I could never learn by just learning it off. If I didn't understand it, I can't learn it. So for me, it was about being able to break it down, being able to work it through. And I suppose that's why I'm saying, you know, with the computational thinking, I see a benefit. I see that it's important that you can break things down. And it applies to maths, but it applies to so many other areas as well. And it's just that idea of figuring out how things work together, how things connect, you know, all of those things. And for me, with the maths, some of the things that I struggled the most with were learning theorems, because I didn't see the benefit of them, whereas I could work through problems and work that way. So, and I suppose one of the other myths around maths is that if you're good at maths, you're good at every part of maths. There's some part of maths I just can't get. I just can't get them. I don't have that kind of a brain, and that's fine. Still work at them. So I think we need to be careful, and I'm a little bit on a soapbox now around maths.
No, that's great.
But I just think sometimes around maths, we have this idea that you're good at it or you're not good at it. You're good at it because you work at it a lot of the time. You can have a predisposition to seeing things in a particular way, but that doesn't mean that you can't work at it and make it work for you. And I also think it's important to recognise that there are lots of different areas in maths, there's lots of different areas in technology, and you don't have to be good at all of them. You can find your niche and you can make it yours.
That's what I find so interesting about what you're saying, because not many people talk about that. Now, people talk about being good at maths or not good at maths, but they don't talk about the parts of it that you might be good at and the parts of it you might be less good at.
Well, I can tell you now that, you know, the cogs and wheels and stuff like that, I cannot visualise those. So if I was here and the only way I can get out the door if it's locked is to do those cogs and wheels, I'd be here all night. I just can't do them. I can't see them. I can work at it, but 9 times out of 10, I'll probably get it wrong. But there's other parts that I just see them. But that's because I've been in that area for years and years and years. So you can have a predisposition to, but that doesn't mean that if you don't have it, that you can't work at it.
But there probably has to be an interest as well.
Yeah, and I love
it. Or some motivation.
Yeah, and I don't know, you know, you were asking about how did I get into maths? I don't know. I genuinely don't know. I just know when I was in secondary school, I was just, I suppose, towards that science and maths area. The technology back in the 80s for me wasn't a huge driving force at all. But, you know, it was always in the science and the maths area that kind of piqued my interest, because the two things I was looking at doing in college were maths and chemistry. And right up to the end, I wasn't sure which one. And I chose maths, thankfully.
What would you say to a secondary teacher who hasn't a background in coding, but who is now, you know, with the minister's priorities and everything, interested in getting into that area? Where would they start?
One of the things that is very frustrating for teachers, I suppose, is that there are so many things you can start with. Where do you actually start? And I think it's about making a start in something. You know, I suppose I've had a lot of experience around Scratch and Microbits and lots of different things. I think it doesn't particularly matter where you start. I think what matters is that you do actually start and that you actually make some attempt to get involved. I think one of the things, if you're getting into coding, one of the things that you need to do is you need to be aware that you're not going to be able to solve all the problems in the beginning, and it will take a while to be confident in the classroom. When I started lecturing, I was lecturing in a language I didn't know 3 weeks before I started lecturing. That first year was difficult, to say the least. I had given up a permanent pensionable job in insurance to go lecturing, and I was like, what did I do that for? But it was actually to move down the country. But it wasn't my most comfortable place to be, but I did love it. And I think sometimes once you realise that actually you don't have to be the expert in the room, that you can guide and you can kind of talk to your students about where the problems might be rather than actually fixing the problem and just helping them to find the solution. The other thing is, the more you get into it, the more confident you become with it. I would say, you know, depending on whether it's primary or secondary, you know, I suppose primary has a bit more flexibility around it. In secondary, it's hard to know where it's going to come into, like, you know, in TY, you can bring in certain things. You know, you could maybe do websites, or you could do App Inventor, or you could do Scratch. Scratch is probably seen as not where to start at TY, but there are other things that you can do out there. You know, there's lots and lots of different things. Microbits, I've just come to them in the last couple of months, and I have to say I love them. It's a block editor as well, but it's a very physical thing, and it seems to work well with students. But I think it's about being confident enough to actually say, I'll try it, and go from there.
And what about, say, a primary teacher at primary level who, maybe the teacher is enthusiastic or interested but mightn't have a great background in coding either? What's the best thing they could do, say, with primary school children to help them at least gain maybe a disposition for coding?
I think it's just allowing them to even, you know, make a start. Get them to have a look at Scratch, get them to have a look at Microbits, get them to have a look at these various different things. There's lots of resources out there. There's Hour of Code, there's code.org. So there's lots of different things that you don't necessarily have to be, like, you can guide them through it, but actually there are a lot of resources out there, particularly at primary level, that you can actually just let them go with, and, you know, they're guided through the process. So you're actually just giving them the opportunity to get it. maybe, you know, see if there's somebody who might come in. I know I've gone to a lot of local schools and there might be somebody, or maybe talk to some of the parents. You know, how I got involved in my daughter's school originally was I was in for, she was in senior infants, and I went in to do just some games around literacy and numeracy with them. And I've been going in since. Now, she's long since gone from the primary school. I'm involved in board of management now. But it's just maybe engage with parents who have those skills, who might be able to maybe help you out. So it's reaching out to people who might be able to. You don't have to do it all yourself. If you reach out to people, they might actually surprise you.
I've been using the word coding. You've been using computer science. How do you see the difference between those terms?
I would see computer science as a broader term. I would see it as encompassing a number of different things. I think sometimes people talk about coding and they're just talking about literally the act of coding. But actually it's about, and you know, I spoke about the computational thinking, the breaking problems down. It's actually about being able to design a solution. And I think a lot of the time, you know, in Coder Dojo and things like that, we are quite focused on coding. But actually, you need to be able to step back from it sometimes too. You have to be able to code. You have to get into it. You can't put too many blocks in the way. You can't put too many barriers in the way. But actually, you do need to be able to break something down. You need to be able to step back from it and think, what am I trying to achieve here? Because if you don't really know where you're trying to go with it, you'll kind of never know if you get there to a certain extent. Or, you know, sometimes I see with kids when they're coding, they have a problem, but when you sit down with them and ask them, well, what are you trying to do? Sometimes they haven't fully thought out what they're trying to do. So they're fixing things without actually knowing what they're trying to fix. And, you know, I love seeing that joy in people when they're coding, but actually you have to help them to do that as well. So for me, computer science is a broader term. It's you know, the computational thinking, it's logically thinking, it's breaking things down. I'm a mathematician by trade. Maybe I do that naturally. I don't know. It's the way I think. It's not the way everyone thinks, and I completely get that as well. But there is a need to be able to break things down, to be able to step back from things, to be able to see what are you trying to do. One of the things we see with our students as well is sometimes in the beginning you're struggling with the syntax and how to put things together, and you focus more on that than you do on what the output should be. So sometimes getting a program to compile is seen as the end game, but actually when it compiles, does it run? Does it give you the output that you need? And if it doesn't give you the output that you need, it's not doing its job. So it's actually understanding, recognizing that it's not giving you the output, and then being able to go back and see, well, why isn't it giving me that output? So it's being able to step back. And sometimes when you do a bit of work at the beginning, you've less to do at the end, because actually you've thought it through and then you've coded it in the way that would work.
Who or what inspires you?
My mum. Lots of people. I mean, there's lots and lots of people. I'm lucky to be surrounded by lots of different people. My mum has been an inspiration for years. She has always valued education. She would be of a generation where, I suppose, they didn't get the opportunities that we get. So she made sure her children, and there are seven of us, so she had a lot to do that. I was the first person in my immediate family to go to college. And that was down to my mum, completely. So she does inspire me. But there are lots of other people, you know, being at SESI, you know, Mags Amond, Catherine Cronin, Mary Loftus, all those people, all these amazing people are just, it's inspirational to be in a place where all these other people are, and you can't help but be challenged to do things differently. Last weekend, the SESI conference was supposed to happen. Pam Moran was supposed to be here. Ira Sockle was supposed to be here as well, but that didn't work out. They inspire me. You know, so many different people inspire me. But I suppose at the end of the day, it comes back to my mum and my dad. But my mum, I suppose, was very much focused on getting us to where she thought we needed to get to.
Have you a favourite book or blog about education?
I kind of dip in and out of a lot of things. There isn't a particular favourite book or blog necessarily. I like Twitter because it's a way of, I suppose, the one thing I do like, and my favourite part is EdChat.ie on a Monday night. Couldn't recommend it highly enough. Teachers come together, talk about things, share resources, talk about various different things along the way. And it's good to have that support of other teachers. It's great to have primary, secondary, third level all in the same space, all talking about it. Because I think in Ireland we have a tendency to, you've got a primary school kid who leaves primary and over the summer is supposed to become this organisational ninja who can do all this stuff. And then they come out of second level and they go into third level and they're supposed to be able to suddenly go from being at home having everything done for them, and I have a son who's in that space now about to go to college, and suddenly we're expecting that they're able to just leave and do all this stuff. So it's great to have the teachers across all the levels, educators across all the levels from different perspectives coming at it, and I suppose that's my favourite resource.
I mean, it's one of the things I love about CESI as well, is the fact that it does combine all levels of education.
You can't sandbox it, and that's one thing that we're very conscious of in the ICT and Education Conference as well, is that we have people from various different parts, and you know, we bring in people sometimes from outside of the education sector altogether, just to give people a different perspective. And sometimes, you know, that works and sometimes it doesn't, but it's just, it's about broadening our horizons, and it's actually about being connected. And I suppose the kind of educator I am now compared to the kind of educator I was when I started 17 years ago, I don't recognise the kind of educator I am now, and that's because I'm in a space where people are doing different things and challenging me to do different things, and it you can't but be inspired.
And the EdChat IE conversation, that takes place across Twitter?
It takes place on Twitter on a Monday night from 8:30 to 9:30.
So how would someone who hasn't done it before, how would they begin to participate in it?
Well, the first thing to do, I suppose, is to sign up to Twitter, because if you're not on there, you can't be in there. And then just put in the search bar, if you just put in #EdChatIE on a Monday night between 8:30 and 9:30, sometimes it's frantic. So in the beginning, just lurk. Watch what's going on. If you see something that comes across your timeline that you like the look of, follow that person, and then follow another person, and follow another person, and follow another person, and then you will see their tweets in your timeline. And then, like, it took me a while to be confident enough to get involved in it. So it is, and it's frantic. Like, I was involved in the one last Monday night.
What was the topic on Monday night?
Monday night was a digital citizen summit. And it was frantic. I mean, it was just frenetic. There was 5 questions, and it was just like, I answered one question, and then I got down about 400 rabbit holes, and I didn't answer any other questions. Normally, it's kind of a topic is put out, and then it's just...
Like, it could be a topic like assessment, or a topic homework.
Yeah, or, you know, how do we introduce technology in the classroom, or... and actually, often... Now, I think last week's one was chosen, but often the topics are actually picked by people, so people can put in their topic during the week, and then there's a vote on what one is going to be for Monday, and that's decided, I think, around 12 noon on Monday. So you can be the person who puts in the topic, and you can be the one who, you know, decides what everyone's going to be talking about next Monday night. But it's the fact that you're meeting people online that are in that same space that you are, that are doing the kinds of things that you're doing. It's just a phenomenal resource. It's phenomenal support, and couldn't recommend it highly enough.
A ringing endorsement there of EdChat IE from Pam O'Brien, bringing this week's Inside Education to a close. You can listen to podcasts of previous Inside Education programmes on seandelaney.com. My book about teaching, Become the Primary Teacher Everyone Wants to Have, can be ordered from your local library. Thanks to this week's guest, Pam O'Brien, and to the organisers of the CESI conference for their hospitality. Until the same time next week, this is Sean Delaney signing off. Thank you for listening.